So last week we talked about crispy California. This week, continued unrest in Portland, Kenosha, Wisconsin. America hasn't seen this level of civil unrest for 50 years. Is this a movement of liberation? Is this lawless anarchy? And we've got, again, another hotly contested election coming up. I think a lot of people are jittery and nervous about the future. America has long been a place of jitters. I think over the last, in the after World War II era, we've enjoyed a degree of peace and stability. But throughout the history of the United States, there have been periods of serious disagreement. In the 1850s, all the eyes of the nation were on Kansas. And as an abolitionist newspaper in New England called it, Bleeding Kansas. Kansas as a territory was coming into the Union, and am I this way? My tape's over there, Rick. Rick's trying to keep me in the frame. He says I wiggle too much. Kansas was coming into the Union, and the Senate was pretty much evenly split between senators from free states and senators from slave states. And so everyone knew if Kansas came in as a free state, the senators could abolish slavery. And if Kansas came in as a slave state, other pro-slave legislation would pass. Does this counting senators and riding on elections, does all this sound familiar? So what happened? People streamed into Kansas, up from Missouri. There were sometimes called ruffians, and then free staters would come in. And what was happening in Kansas was basically gang warfare. You had towns and cities that were free staters and pro-slavery ones, and it was very violent. Newspapers around the country took sides. You didn't have Fox News and MSNBC, but you had different newspapers from all over the United States. And so newspapers were sort of the critical thing that everybody watched. And in Lawrence, Kansas, which was a free stater, there were two newspapers. And there was a raid by the pro-slavery people, and they smashed the printing presses. And the abolitionists were upset. So one night, John Brown, a couple of his sons, John Brown had moved to Kansas, a couple of his sons and a couple of friends went out and found people that they suspected of smashing those printing presses. And they interrogated the men and two of their adolescent sons, and they took broadswords with them. And they interrogated these men in the middle of the night, and the two sons and John Brown and his band hacked to death five individuals. This was May of 1856. It's called the Pottawatomie Massacre. John Brown was not arrested, and John Brown continued to do what he was doing. His idea was to incite a slave revolt. Nat Turner, a generation before, had tried it in Virginia. About 50 or 60 slaves rose up. It was put down fairly easily, even though they had a majority in that county of slaves over whites. John Brown's idea was they were going to arm the slaves. They were going to take the Harper's Ferry Armory, which was lightly guarded. No one was expecting any trouble. And so they were actually successful in taking the armory. And they sent out runners to try to rouse the slaves and distribute weapons. John Brown could be pretty bloody, but he wasn't a very good planner. And the thing was a catastrophe, and he was arrested. There was no slave revolt. He then would be executed for the crime of probably treason, and he was hung on a gallows, but he left a note. And that note, I've mentioned it before, haunted the United States. I, John Brown, am now quite certain that the crimes of this guilty land will never be purged away but with blood. It was 1859. April 12, 1861, the state of South Carolina decided to secede from the Union. There was an island offshore, Charleston Harbor, Fort Sumter. They fired on Fort Sumter and took the fort, and the Civil War began. Whoops, wrong button. Why didn't the slaves free themselves? The population of slaves in the South was quite robust. There were quite a few slaves. Again, the Nat Turner Rebellion was an attempt. Nat Turner was a preacher, very interesting man if you get a chance to read his biography. Slave owners lived in perpetual fear of slave uprisings. Throughout history, there have been a number of attempts at slave uprisings, but they're almost always put down. Why? Slavery isn't just something with shackles and chains. Slavery is something that inhabits our hearts. Our freedoms are not exactly what we imagine them to be. Most slaves didn't free themselves. A few might escape. In the Civil War, some would fight for the Union Army. Many more would become laborers. But it was actually the sons of Northern families that gave their blood to free the slaves. Most of these young men didn't start the war in order to end slavery. They started the war to save the Union. Over time, the war increasingly became about slavery, even though quite obviously it was started over slavery. And many decided they wanted to save the Union, and they gave their lives for it. Wrong button again. Now, we're at the point in our story where Israel is going to be freed. Now, the Lord had said to Moses, "I will bring one more plague on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. And when he does, he will drive you out completely. Tell the people that men and women alike are to ask their neighbors for articles of silver and gold. The Lord made the Egyptians favorably disposed towards the people, and Moses himself was highly regarded in Egypt by Pharaoh's officials and by the people." So Moses said, "This is what the Lord says. About midnight, I will go through Egypt. Every firstborn son in Egypt will die. From the firstborn son of Pharaoh, who sits on the throne, to the firstborn son of the female slave, who is at her handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle as well. There will be loud wailing throughout Egypt, worse than there ever has been or ever will be again. But among the Israelites, not a dog will bark at any person or animal. Then you will know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. All these officials of yours will come to me, bowing down before me, saying, 'Go, you and all the people who follow you. After that, I will leave.' Then Moses, hot with anger, left Pharaoh." Little note here, it's a rather confusing passage because this is really in the mind of Moses because he's not there with Pharaoh in the story. But this gives us an image of how they're going to part. If you remember last week, Pharaoh already banished Moses from the court, and Moses said, "You won't see my face again." The Lord had said to Moses, "Pharaoh will refuse to listen to you so that my wonders may be multiplied in Egypt." It's a little summary verse. Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let the Israelites go out of his country. It's a summary of the story. And then chapter 12. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, "This month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household." Now we're going through the story, and we've been going through this story for chapters, and it's been building and building and building and building, and now we get to chapter 12, At the end of chapter 11, we have this total break in the story to give us a summary. And at the beginning of chapter 12, we're going to talk about the calendar. Now, what year is this year, as if any of us could remember? Forget. 2020. 2020 AD. Anybody know what the AD means? Anno Domini, which in Latin means? Anybody know what? Year of our Lord. Why does the calendar peg to the birth of Jesus? Well, calendar is pegged to the birth of Jesus. This didn't happen sort of until the Middle Ages, because if you read the Bible carefully, one of the things that you notice is that in the ancient world, the calendar was always pegged to the birth of a certain king. In the fourth year of David's reign, in the 30th year of David's reign, Anno Domini was a way of the Western calendar saying, this is the reign of Christ. Now pay attention in this story, right before the Passover, reset the calendar. This is the beginning of a crucial time in the history of the world. It is the beginning of the people of Israel. Pause the story, reset your calendar. Another pause in the story, everybody needs to get a lamb. What? We need to get a lamb? I thought God was going to free us. Now, what's interesting about this story is right here we have a ritual. And no ancient person would give a second thought to what's about to come. Modern people, on the other hand, wonder. So God's going to free us from Egypt. It's not going to involve some army from another nation. It's not going to involve a slave revolt. It has everything to do with killing a lamb or a goat. Modern people don't imagine there are any other beings besides human beings, unless until we find aliens. And there's no one when we pray or talk or do anything who is watching. There are no conscious agents above or beyond us with whom we can communicate, relate, rely upon, or with whom to associate, who may in any way change the circumstances of the physical world. The ancients did not believe that. This modern idea is an assertion. You cannot prove it, you cannot disprove it. The animal you must choose must be a year old male without defect. And you may take them from the sheep or from the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month. Remember, we restarted the calendar. We started the month. Take this animal, care for it nicely until the fourth day, the 14th day. Then the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Just as day starts to turn to night. Remember last week? Darkness. Look at the symbolism through this story. Day is turning to night. Daytime, we saw that in some of the songs we sing. Daytime is a time of order where we can see. Nighttime is a night of chaos where we are blind. Lately, we've been looking at the air and it's all dark and the sun is red and the moon is red and you just have this sense of the world is not as it should be. So take this little lamb, a year old, and slaughter it. And then take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where you eat the lamb. That same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over a fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or boiled in water, but roast it over a fire with head, legs, and internal organs. Now you might say, well, this is very peculiar. Later on in the book of in the law of Moses, we're going to have very peculiar rules about making sure all the blood drains from an animal that you eat. And the animal, you drain the blood out, you smear the blood on a doorpost, you leave the internal organs in, and you roast it over a fire. and you have bread without yeast. What's going on? This entire thing is a picture of chaos and urgency and breakdown. Do not leave any until morning. If some is left till morning, you take out Tupperware and you put it in there. No, you don't. There's no Tupperware. You burn it in the fire. And this is a culture in which meat eating is not a regular event. Now again, we have intimations here of sacrifice. We have blood. Later on when we have an altar, there'll be blood sprinkled on an altar. Now we're putting blood on a door frame. And we're not really dressing the animal like you might see in the TV series Alone, where you take all the guts so the guts don't contaminate the meat and all of those things. You leave it all in, you kill the animal, you cook it on a fire. If anything's left over, you burn it as if it's an altar, as if it goes into a sacrifice. All of these detailed descriptions are specific, as if their life and death will depend on it, and it will. Again, for us moderners, this is strange. Well, who cares? I like my lamb cooked this way. This is how you are to eat it. And with your cloak tucked into your belt, because that left your legs free, and your sandals on your feet, you took them off when you went in the home because the sandals were full of animal droppings, because that's what's in the street, and your staff in your hand, get the picture. The whole family huddled around a fire. What, that blood on the door frames. Everyone ready to travel. It's the ancient version of a drive-through almost. They're ready to go. Nothing will be left. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals, and I will strike judgment on the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. He's not making any questions about who's doing this. The blood will be a sign for you on the house where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt. From the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on the throne. You have intimations of equality here in the story. In the ancient world, status was everything. Pharaoh was a god. Doesn't matter. In the eyes of God, Pharaoh, the firstborn of the prisoner who's in a dungeon, and the firstborn of the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was a loud wailing in Egypt, and there was not a house without someone dead. You think jitters on the news or something? The American Civil War, many, many, many died. This is a picture of chaos, of sorrow, of the day of the Lord, because the Lord comes, and who can stand? During the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, "Up, leave my people, you and all the Israelites. Go and worship the Lord as you as requested. Take your flocks and herds, and as you have said, and go. And also bless me." We started this story with Pharaoh saying, "And who is the Lord?" Well, now he knows, and now he's in terror. And when you go, pray for me. God, Pharaoh says. The Egyptians urged the people to hurry and leave the country, for otherwise, they said, we will all die. So the people took their dough before the yeast was added and carried it on their shoulders in kneading troughs wrapped in clothing. The Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and clothing. The Lord had made the Egyptians favorably disposed towards the people, and they gave them what they had asked for, so they plundered this Egyptian. Now, watch yourself as you listen to this story and ask yourself, which frame am I in? Because if you see the picture of these are brutal slave owners who deserve nothing but death for the genocide and the brutality that they have perpetrated on this people, In that frame, you're like, ah, they're getting what they deserve. But switch it to another frame, and the firstborn, they didn't make the decisions. Pharaoh made the decisions. Everyone in Egypt suffered because of the decision of Pharaoh. So are the Egyptians perpetrators getting what they deserve? Or are they victims of this ruthless, brutal, terrifying God? After the Lord brings you into the land of Canaan and gives to you, he's talking to Israel now, I jumped out a few chapters, and as he promised on an oath to you and your ancestors, you're going somewhere, Israel. You are to give over to the Lord the first offspring of every womb. All the firstborn males of your livestock belong to the Lord. Redeem with a lamb every firstborn donkey. But if you do not redeem it, break its neck. Redeem every firstborn from among your sons. So here's the question. Is this justice? Egypt getting what it deserves? Or is this an atrocity? The brutal demands of a bloodthirsty God. What's interesting here is that who pays to redeem the slaves of Egypt? Pharaoh doesn't die. The innocent children of the enemy die. The innocent offspring of the sheep and the goats die. Someone else paid for Israel's freedom. Israel was to remember this on penalty from exile of the community. Why must every firstborn be redeemed? The calendar started. This is your identity. This is who you are. You live in this world because others paid for you to be here. Others sacrificed for your welfare. Your benefit is at the expense of others. Every year you are to remember this. Every year they had to take the life of an innocent lamb, and you can imagine the children happy when the spring lambs come. Oh, aren't they cute? They gamble around, they're pretty. Hope the kids don't name it. Why are you bringing in the lamb? Why don't you kill one of those old bedraggled sheep, the ones that aren't pretty and full of life and make me joyful? Every year they had to take the life of an innocent lamb to remember that they were not their own. Their freedom was purchased by the sacrifice of the innocent. Now, one of my favorite shows on TV is Alone, where people go up into the wilderness and they try to live up there in the Arctic for as long as they possibly can. And every year it's sort of the same. About all they can trap are some bunnies or some fish, and so they trap these hares, and those bunnies are so cute, or the little squirrels. And what do all these survivalist contestants do after they've been out there in the wilderness? I'm sorry, I have to kill you, but I need to eat. The life of a game show contestant is preserved at the cost of the animals. Civilization covers this up. Oh, you can buy a rabbit at the store. It comes in a nice cellophane package. Doesn't have those pretty little eyes looking up at you. You came into this world, though, at the risk and cost of the lives of others, each one of us. You live in a land that was taken in bloodshed. You might say, oh, yeah, the ones we displaced. But guess what? The ones that were here when Columbus got here, they had displaced a generation before them, and they had displaced a generation before them. Each successive generation of this world does to the previous ones what will be done to them. It is the way of the world. We eat by the death of plants and of animals. We don't feel so bad about the plant because we don't get an emotional connection, but our life at their expense. We are not our own. This whole story points to a bigger picture. God looks like a moral monster. The God of Israel, however, is not like the gods of Egypt. The imagined gods of Egypt and polytheism imagined that gods were little beings in an impersonal universe that sort of act. The God of Israel is not like that. The God of Israel is the author of the system and can be an actor within it, such as the angel of the Lord or the angel of death. Egypt had power and agency by the sacrifice of the children of Egypt, of Israel. And now Israel will have her freedom by the sacrifice of the Egyptians and of the animals. We think freedom is free. Well, that's just the nature of things. No, it never is. Things die so that we can live. We can sing about it as the circle of life and the Lion King, but that's because we're looking at cartoons. We have debts that we do not know and bonds and scars we do not see. We are like children who can't see the sacrifices of their parents. Didn't turn off the... We are like children who can't see the sacrifices of their parents and ancestors who bought their freedom and agency with their lives. We all know this. We don't think about it. We fear a God who would kill and demand the firstborn. The firstborn is only a token of what he owns. The firstborn is first fruits. Question we really have is, can he be trusted? Because if he has that much power, sort of like the computer, pull out the plug of the computer, whoop, down we go. He kills the firstborn with a thought. Reminds us of someone who could raise the dead with a word. The unthinkable happens. The owner of the system reciprocates. Now, some of us play computer games and we create little characters that run on in little screens and little systems. Would we die for a program that we made? The owner of the system reciprocates and sacrifices to free the slaves of other parts of the system. You see, if you just have the Passover story, the dominant narrative continues that the God has all rights, the God has all power, the God can bring justice, and Israel can be subjected to Egypt, and Israel then can demand the blood of the Egyptians in payment for the suffering and the blood that Egypt had shared. And round and back and forth we go. Africans enslaving Israelites, Europeans enslaving Africans, on and on and on and on. We have short memories, remember a few decades or a few hundred years, and that's it. But this cycle just continues in the world. And at this moment in time, the story says the firstborn of God gives his life for the people who don't deserve it. He gives his firstborn son. There are patterns here. On the night in which he was betrayed, he took bread and he broke it. We should probably have props next month. He took bread and he broke it. What was Jesus saying? What night was that? Why was Jesus gathered with his disciples for a meal? They were there for the Passover. Well, what is the Passover? They were remembering that Israel was free by the blood of the firstborn of Egypt. And Israel was free by the blood of the lambs. And all over Israel in that night, they were preparing for the Passover. And Jesus steps up and says, I am the lamb. That lamb that you kill for the blood, for the deliverance. I am the lamb. I am the firstborn. My death will redeem you. The Passover pattern was ritualized and remembered, and generation after generation after generation understood the pattern of life. Jesus' sacrifice is ritualized. It is the pattern of the world. It is the pattern of sacrifice. It is also the pattern of liberation. Now, as we have received, we give. That's what it means. So on the night our Lord was betrayed, take off the little cover here. Be glad when we've got real elements again. He took bread and he broke it. And he said, "This is my body. This is the body of the Lamb that is about to die, so the angel of death will pass over. This is my body, given for you. As often as you eat this, remember me." Israel, that was so careful with blood, don't eat meat with blood in it. On that night, take that lamb, slaughter it, take the blood, put it in a bowl, put it on the doorpost of the house, and when the Lord comes, he will pass over. Jesus said, "This is my blood poured out for you." The old covenant you saw on the doorpost of the houses of the slaves in Egypt. This is my blood poured out for you. When you drink this, remember, my blood was poured out so the angel of death would pass over and you can live.